Welcome to the Hello Someday podcast, the podcast for busy women who are ready to drink less and live more. I'm Casey McGuire Davidson, ex-red wine girl turned life coach, helping women create lives they love without alcohol. But it wasn't that long ago that I was anxious, overwhelmed, and drinking a bottle of wine a night to unwind. I thought that wine was the glue holding my life together, helping me cope with my kids, my stressful job, and my busy life. I didn't realize that my love affair with drinking was making me more anxious and less able to manage my responsibilities. In this podcast, my goal is to teach you the tried and true secrets of creating and living a life you don't want to escape from. Each week, I'll bring you tools, lessons, and conversations to help you drink less and live more. I'll teach you how to navigate our drinking-obsessed culture without a buzz, how to sit with your emotions when you're lonely or angry, frustrated or overwhelmed, how to self-soothe without a drink, and how to turn the decision to stop drinking from your worst-case scenario to the best decision of your life. I am so glad you're here. Now let's get started. Hey there. I've got some big news for you that I have been not so patiently waiting to tell you about. After 6 months away, my super popular, completely free masterclass is back, and it's better than ever. I've been working on it 4 months, so if you have been struggling to get sober momentum, please go to hellosomedaycoaching.com/class. You can sign up for my free training, 5 secrets to taking a break from drinking, even if you've tried and failed in the past. In this 60-minute masterclass, I am going to share with you all the things you need to stop doing because they're setting you up for self-sabotage and what you need to start doing instead. I am giving you the steps and the mindset shifts that I go through every day with my private coaching clients, and it is completely free. So if you are sober curious, if you've been thinking about taking a break from alcohol, this class is going to set you up for success. I promise you, it is worth your time. So hit pause on this episode, go to hellosomedaycoaching.com/class and save your seat. Hi there. Today we are talking to Christy Coulter, author of the new memoir, Exit Interview, and author of Nothing Good Can Come From This, a finalist for the Washington State Book Award. And her work has appeared in New York Magazine, The Paris Review, Elle, Glamour, and many other publications. She lives in Seattle and LA with her husband and Golden Retriever. And Christy also came on this podcast right when it started. I think she was episode 18 on working, drinking, and being a first world woman. So if you want to listen to that one, it's hellosomedaycoaching.com/18. Christy and I actually go way back. I heard her on a podcast when I was, I think, 97 days sober. So this is over 7 years ago. I had heard her on a podcast. So if you're listening to this, I actually have people reach out to me all the time and wrote her, found her email, not that I'm a stalker, and wrote her and was like, hey, you're in Seattle. I'm in Seattle. You worked in tech. I work in tech. And I'm sober and never expected to hear from her. And Christy, welcome. You wrote me back like 3 days later.
Yeah, I was thrilled because I was like, are there any sober women in Seattle? I think I had said something on the podcast about like, I need friends who are sober and there's nobody here. And you were like, hi, I'm here. So of course I was going to write you back. It was like, and then we met in person not that long after. Yeah.
Well, it was months, probably. We both were pen pals. Belle Robertson from About Drinking, she was my coach.
And she wasn't my coach, but I had done the challenge. We were friendly at that point.
And she came to Seattle and we all met at a coffee shop.
Yeah.
Just a Starbucks in a neighborhood.
And then our friend Ingrid started doing like sober women dinner parties, which was so cool. And
that was really fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. So we go way back. If anyone hasn't read the book, Nothing Good Can Come From This, definitely do. We're going to talk about it in this interview. But after we met, and I felt like, oh my God, I know a famous person, you wrote this article that went completely viral called Angelie. And like in every sober book group I was in, people were talking about it and sharing it. It was wonderful.
Thank you. That went insane. That was, you know, I slapped that up there to see if I could get a couple hundred reads or something. And like 8 days later, I was on like Radio Scotland. I've never had anything like that happen in my life. I mean, most people won't, you know, it's just one of those things where lightning strikes. And someone from Medium where I published it had, an editor just liked it. And so they, you know, promoted it. And it just took off from there. It was the craziest experience of my life.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I think it really, it was incredibly well written. And it was like that perfect blend of like sarcasm slash snarky slash earnest, which I'm a big fan of. But
right.
What do you think it was about that article that like resonated with people who were like on this sober path or women in working?
Yeah, I think part of it was that, you know, it was well written and it was funny, I think, which people are not used to when they're reading about sobriety. It tends to be super earnest. But I think it just hit something in the zeitgeist that I thought only bothered me, which was the selling of drinking to women as feminism.
Yeah.
Over drinking, especially, you know, that like, oh, drinking means you've made it. Drinking means you've arrived. And I had been sober almost 3 years at that point. And I realized that I had been drinking to tolerate my life. And so it just started to annoy me that like women were being told that drinking and having hangovers means you've achieved equality with men, essentially. Because I was like, you have not achieved equality with men. And also, this is not the kind of equality you want, you know, to like also die of alcohol related causes. And so it turned out a lot of people were also just women were like, oh, I didn't realize this was bothering me, but it is.
Yeah.
And I had articulated that. And then it also just made a ton of people mad at me too. Like men were furious. Oh my God. Oh yeah. I mean, the usual men who are just losers hated me, you know, like they were like, you know, feminazi was thrown at me. And, but there were some women who were just furious to the point where I was like, okay, this sounds a little too personal. What's going on? Like,
I think you protest too much.
Exactly. I mean, they were just like, one woman was like, I'm writing in utter loathing. And I was like, girl, I'm not worth that kind of rent-free space in your in your head. Like, what's going on? Because I don't, even then, like, I don't care if other people drink. Like, do what you want. I was not like coming to take your margarita from you. So there was all this anger and like getting ridiculed. Like the New York Post ridiculed me. And I remember my office mate at Amazon at one point, she said, oh, have you seen Time Magazine today? And I was like, that's a weird question to ask. And I was like, there's only one reason you're asking that, right? They're writing about me.
How is that not in your bio? Like,
I know, right?
I would add that one in.
I should. Especially because growing up in the 70s, you know, my parents subscribed to Time.
Oh, yeah, my grandparents did.
Yeah, exactly. It was like we had Time and U.S. News and World Report. And I remember going through Time magazines like a two-year-old just looking at the pictures. So it was really weird. And they were like Time. I mean, it's Time. They weren't like abusive, but they were definitely like, yeah, she thinks that the patriarchy is making women drink and that's stupid. And I just remember being like, this is so strange. But also knowing that being ridiculed in these national magazines, I was like, this is good. Like, this is making it. This is opportunity.
Yeah.
And I had a book deal, you know, like 2 weeks later. So
that's insane. That's
insane. So I'm like, ridicule all you want.
Well, I have to say that I was in all the sober groups. I had taken HIP sobriety school with Holly Whitaker before she wrote Quit Like a Woman. I was in a bunch of these and every woman I knew was like, oh my God, I fucking love this. Like, this is, you have to read it. You were passing it around and you're completely right. And this is related to Exit Interview, your new book. It talked about how we do drink to tolerate the, you know, death of a thousand cuts of like microaggressions and stress and overwhelm and imposter syndrome and bullshit. And then all the expectations of how you should look and how you should act. And, you know, women bond over drinking when they can't express how awful this shit is, right?
Right, right, right. Because you're not going to say to someone, oh, let's have, I mean, I might now, but you wouldn't be like, let's have coffee and vent about how difficult.
Now I totally would.
Well, yeah, now I'd be like, let's just get it out. But, you know, you would have drinks and then you'd, you know, I love you too. And then it's like, sometimes I feel like an imposter. And then it's, you know, all that. But right, at the time you couldn't. It's funny, there were some, I was just thinking, there were some men in sober groups who were really mad at me. Like, women were mostly, the sober women were cool, but there were some men who were like, if you're expressing anger, that means you're a dry drunk. You know, a real sober person would just be grateful all the time. And I was just like, oh, come on. You know, it was actually really disappointing that sober men decided to line up on the side of like
men.
Men.
And it wasn't even anti-men. It was just funny, sarcastic, snarky, because it was so pointed and insightful. Like, things are funny because they're true. And memoir on like the way you see the world or like why you drink and the clarity that comes when you stop drinking. And I don't know any woman who has stopped drinking who doesn't go through like the sadness and blaming themselves and like wishing for the romantic version and then feeling other than, and then anger. Like,
right, right.
The alcohol companies, this is bullshit. Like,
yeah. Anger's real, and there is plenty for any woman, sober or not, to be angry about. Like, I think these men would say, like, the fact that I'm angry about what happened with Roe v. Wade, they'd probably be like, well, where's your gratitude? Well, fuck my gratitude. There is no gratitude.
Yeah.
You took my bodily autonomy away. So, like, sorry, I'm not going to thank you for that. And, and I think that was really,
I have fewer rights than my mother had. Thank you for
that. Yeah. Like gratitude, you know, and it's funny. I've been saying to people, I don't know if you've seen Barbie yet, but,
yes. And there were parts of your book that I underlined.
Yes.
I was like, I texted them to you last night. I was like,
yeah.
Oh my God. This is the speech from Barbie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so true and it's so universal.
It was so wild, like the speech about how it's impossible to be a woman. Because, you know, Anjali talked about that some. And then this book, you know, has some stuff in it. But also, I've been telling people, I've seen, actually seen Barbie 3 times now, which I didn't plan to, but it just keeps happening. And being anti-patriarchy and being anti-man are two completely different things. Right. Like patriarchy is a system that, yes, was built by and for men. But like, people keep saying, oh, the movie's misandrist. And I'm like, it is anti-patriarchy. The movie has great affection for its male characters, despite the fact that they don't really do anything.
And I kind of love Alan. Does everyone love Alan?
I love Alan. Alan with his little knit romper from 1964.
Oh my God, I love it. And
he's great.
So the other thing I love is, I mean, I'm a child of the 90s, right? Mm-hmm. You know, graduated high school in 93, college in 97. So first of all, the Indigo Girls song. I was like,
yes.
Love this song.
I know.
I also loved, oh my God, was it Matchbox 20? The song with that the men sing like, I want to push you around.
Yeah.
Like, I want to take you for granted. But I loved when all the guys were playing the guitar. Sorry for anyone who hasn't seen it. And all the Barbies are like looking up with them fluttering their eyelashes. Like, this does apply to the book. And then they all stand up and leave the guys. And the guys go from popped up to brutally insecure. And I was like, oh my God, I fucking love that so much.
Yeah. Like, it was amazing. And that song, like, of course I'd heard that song, but you know, I grew up in the 80s. So, and I was like, wow, this song was, I mean, the song, that's, it's a brutal song. It was, no,
but I always
song.
Loved it, but I never thought about the words. I mean, it's got a great,
right.
But then when you listen to the words, you're like, holy shit.
I was like, wait a second. And I can see how it's like, you know, just like people talk about like in sex, like there could be consensual violence or whatever, and that's fine. And in this past little song, maybe it's fine. But I was like, the way that they're singing it, it really, it just sounds awful. And yeah, that was, that's, I really, honestly, I love the movie. I think it's great.
You know, it's just looking funny. We actually saw the Barbie movie because we couldn't get tickets to Taylor Swift. So we went on night when Taylor Swift was in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And it was my daughter and one of her best friends and me and one of her best friend's moms. So two moms, 2 9-year-old girls. And yeah. Lila and I always talk about the patriarchy. We talk about diet culture. We talk about the industrial beauty complex, which is hysterical because I used to work at L'Oreal. I'm like, right. Fun and bullshit.
You know, like, yeah.
Enjoy all your makeup unless you feel like you're less than without it. Do it because it's fun. But right. We talk about the patriarchy. Like, she has t-shirts. Like, it's a beautiful day to smash the patriarchy.
I love it.
So she, like, we went in there and she was like, she got it. She completely got it. But there were parts where America Ferrera, the woman, was talking to all the 40-year-old moms. And we were like, and her best friend's mother were like, fuck, I have not seen a movie in ages that talks to me this way.
Exactly. It's really unusual. And I see a ton of movies, including like lots of like art house, indie, feminist films. And like for a movie like this, this like candy colored summer comedy to talk, I don't know that I've ever heard the word patriarchy in one of these films.
Certainly, and to talk not, like directly. Times, right?
Exactly. I was stunned. And the first time I saw it, I was like, well, you know, the explanation of feminism is a little 101, a little basic. But then I was like, look, get your head out of your ass, Christy. Like, I've taken graduate level women's classes.
I know. I was going to say, like, I don't know if PhD type stuff on feminism needs to be.
Right. Like, yeah. I read, you know, French feminists in the original French. I was like, they are not talking to you, but like girls and women, grown women who have not been steeped in that stuff. Like, I honestly think in like 10 years, we could look back at the triad of Barbie, the summer of Taylor Swift, and the Dobbs decision as like the moment a spark got lit in a lot of young, you know, grown women, but also like young girls. I think there will be like think pieces in 10 years. I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope it doesn't just fade away.
Yeah.
But totally. So
I texted you last night and there were two different parts of your book that I was like, would you be up for reading either of these? I want to start with the part that is related to what we just talked about because it was so right on. Professional help, but both of them reminded me of this. Well, okay. Step back. No one knows what exit interview's about. Worked at Amazon forever. We know each other way too well. So tell us about your book.
Yes. So my book is called Exit Interview. The subtitle is The Life and Death of My Ambitious Career. And basically, I worked at Amazon in fairly high level roles for 12 years. And this book is a memoir. It's a memoir of my entire working life, but it's especially a memoir of working at Amazon in an environment. First of all, the Amazon environment, which is notoriously brutal, can confirm what you've heard in the news. And also as a woman in that environment, where at my level, I think it was like 20% female. You know, at Amazon, when you start at entry level, it's about 50-50 gender balance. And then women just disappear as you go up the levels. And by the time you get to like senior vice presidents, it's minuscule. I think it's like less than 10%. So I wanted to write about that. And when I left Amazon, I was in the 98th percentile for tenure, meaning I'd been there longer than 98% of all employees globally. And I was not offered an in-person exit interview. And
that's insane. That is,
it really did not sit well with me.
12 years of your life.
Yeah, as one of very few women in a high leadership role. And I was just like, you know, I want to have my say. Yeah. So I thought, well, maybe I'll just write a book instead.
They're like, giving her a goddamn exit. Yeah.
There was one review on Goodreads, an early reviewer, and she was like, you know, I didn't like this book because it's called Exit Interview, but she doesn't get an exit interview. And I was kind of like, well, that's the point. Like, I know I didn't get an exit interview. That's why I wrote it. But I know there's all this curiosity about Amazon as a working environment, just because there's been so much reporting. But there hadn't been a really inside story. And I think the last memoir about Amazon was written like almost 20 years ago, maybe a full 20 years ago. Yeah. I mean, I read it when I was interviewing for Amazon. It's by a guy named James Marcus, who was like an early employee at a time when it was a very, very different company, a tiny company. It's a great book, but it was just, you know, it's a different world now. The other thing is, I noticed that women don't write about work enough.
When I was drinking, I used alcohol to calm my mind, to relieve anxiety, and to sleep well at the end of a busy day. I didn't know that alcohol actually spiked my stress hormone, increased anxiety, and as little as one glass of wine a night reduced my sleep quality by 24%. I was really excited to find Tenacity, a better way to find calm, rest, relief, and to reduce inflammation. Tenacity creates the highest quality, scientifically validated CBD and hemp extract products. Tenacity's formula includes a unique combination of CBD and CBDA in every dose, which is 2 times more effective than just CBD alone. So if you want to create a sense of calm, to calm your mind, to relax before bed for a great night of sleep, try Tenacity. Tenacity is being really generous with our listeners. You can go to Tenacity.com and use code HELLO to get 25% off at checkout right now. That's TANASI.com. To get 25% off your first order with the promo code HELLO, and get ready to sleep well. Oh my gosh. Can we talk about perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause for a minute? I am 48, so if you're going through it, I'm right there with you. I mean, hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts, the low moods, the poor sleep, it is not cool. And that's why I was really excited to find a supplement called Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth. It contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors like those super fun hormonal changes. It helps reduce menopause symptoms head on. And if you're interested in trying it, you can use the code HELLO for 15% off your first order. Women cannot stop raving about it on social media, but the biggest benefit is the simplest: feeling like yourself again. So if you're going through this, like I'm going through this, for a limited time, you can get 15% off your first order at happymammoth.com with promo code HELLO. That's happy, MAMMOTH.com. And use promo code HELLO for 15% off your first order.
There are not a lot of memoirs out there, really by men either, but especially by women, about their working lives. And I thought that was crazy because we spend so much time at work, and work is, you know, we meet spouses at work, we act out like old family dramas, we have friendships. And I just thought, why don't we write about work? I think the office is a really interesting place. And so I wanted to do that too.
Can I read you something that someone wrote me with a podcast need, idea, et cetera, like a week ago? And I wrote her back and I was like, I am interviewing Christy Coulter. We're going to talk about this.
Oh, great. But
I mean, a lot of your book also mentions drinking. I mean, you drank a lot at Amazon, as I did in all of my places. You talk about drinking a bottle of wine a night. You talk about getting sober and navigating the workplace without alcohol. So I want to read you this email as sort of framing some of what we're talking about. So she said, I'm an older woman executive working in consulting for the financial services industry. I find that the culture is quasi-toxic. It's all about upping the ante, doing more with less. I have listened to many of your podcasts, and I think it would be great to have one on how to handle corporate stress, literally. For example, how do you handle an endless array of meetings as the entire company can book meetings on my calendar, the pressure to constantly do more, the feeling of always being behind and undervalued, working on the weekends, dealing with senior management that produces production reports on output. Like, what do you do to cope with these pressures and not drink? And I was just like, that's your whole book. That's why I drank.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. So I drank for about half my Amazon career, and I was sober for about half of it. So I had this really interesting, like, A-B test in tech terms. And I would say, you know, I don't know that I coped that much better sober. It's not like it was a magic bullet to make my work stress go away. When I first quit, I kind of was like, I was in a job at Amazon that it was not the right role for me. And it was also a complete clusterfuck. You know, it was just like, there was just no way to succeed, both because of my natural inclinations and because it was a disaster. And I thought, oh, if I just get sober, I'll have more energy and be more focused and I'll nail this job. Yeah. And about six months into sobriety, I was like, okay, I am much sharper and clearer now. And I know this is a disaster. I could very clearly see what a mess the organization was, and also that it was a bad job for me personally. And I was kind of mad. I was like, what? Sobriety was supposed to fix all this. I'm still miserable, you know? And what I ended up doing was changing roles. And the nice thing about a company like Amazon is it's huge. There's always a job somewhere, you know, and they encourage you. I mean, they welcome people moving around. So I actually kind of took a step back. I took a job that was easy for me most of the time, and I felt really guilty about that. But then I realized, like, nobody cared. Like, it was okay if I did that. And I even had coffee with a VP at one point, and I said, I feel really guilty that I've done this. And she was like, why? Everybody has to coast at some point.
Yeah.
And I was like, really? I'm allowed?
Guilty. Did you feel guilty about, like, I'm not representing women by climbing up? Did you feel guilty about, like, disappointing people? Like, what was it?
Well, it was the first job in my life that the first role I'd ever really felt like I failed at. And I mean, when I say fail, like, I was fine. I was doing okay, but there were people who would be better at it. So part of it was that, like, I was the kind of person who always did even better than people expected. And for the first time, I was like, oh, I'm not good at this. And so that, I had this shame around that. And then I also felt Amazon wants you to feel guilty if you're not almost drowning at every point. You're not doing enough unless you're doing too much. And I took this job where, I mean, I did have to learn a lot of new stuff, and at times it was really, really challenging. But for long stretches, I was like, oh, I'm actually a little bit bored. Like, this is really, really chill. It was in leadership development, which operated almost like an academic department. So it was like going from Amazon to a university, you know, like just this quiet office. And I just felt like, oh, I'm not being a true Amazonian, which was,
because I don't want to, like, kill myself, or, you know, metaphoric.
Right. And the thing is, nobody was telling me that. It was all me. And eventually I came down to, like, okay, but do you want to stay sober?
Yes.
Because you need this rest. You absolutely, and I thought about leaving the company, but I was like, yeah, if I can take this job, and it was set up as a rotational role. So I was going to be in it for, it was supposed to be 2 years. I ended up leaving a little before that. I was like, just take this break. Take it. I thought of it as like an internal sabbatical. And I had basically had to choose myself over being like the perfect Amazonian.
Well, when so I chose to be happier and healthier, right?
Like, yeah, for the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think so. I've seen this so much with the women I work with and mm-hmm. with myself, where a lot of times we drink to tolerate the life that we are living, right? The right. endless demands, the death of a thousand cuts, the unreasonable work expectations for people mm. of family, you know, all those things. And then you stop drinking and yes, mm. you no longer have the hangovers and the extra anxiety and all the shit that comes with it.
Right.
But you still like, you're still living the same life you were drinking to tolerate. And so then you need to shift different parts of it. And, but you see it clearly and you realize you're not a victim and right. you don't have that like crushing, I suck. If anyone knew, you mm-hmm. know, shit going on. But mm-hmm. yeah, I have a client who worked at a private university and was dean of students and went back to being faculty full time without
right.
that. I have clients who've like, switch jobs to like you, like an internal transfer. And mm-hmm. I did that as well at L'Oreal, but it wasn't by choice because mm-hmm. I just apparently can't quit jobs I hate.
Right.
God knows why. But uh-huh. I was in line for a promotion to VP. I talked with my mm-hmm. boss about it like multiple times. I basically was like doing her job for a year. And mm-hmm. then there was a huge reorg. And I got transferred laterally to a new group that they didn't consult me on. They took my team away. They gave it to someone who I thought was utterly unqualified, who I'm sure does not listen to this podcast. And I was rageful. I was like, mm-hmm. I worked here for 3 fucking years. I wouldn't have interviewed mm-hmm. for this job. This is bullshit. Yada, yada, yada. Turns out it was the best thing that ever could have happened to me. Like mm-hmm. my new boss was amazing. Most of the people were on the East Coast. So by 4:00, I was left alone. It nice. Was like yeah. wait, you're going to pay me the exact same money to Fresh. Not be so stressed. I'm waking up at midnight with my alarm to check the numbers. Like, mm-hmm. oh my God, this is amazing. Yeah, like,
thank you. Yeah.
That did enable me to be happier and to stay sober. Mm-hmm. And just, I was like, I didn't know how much lighter I could feel. And this woman's right. email goes back to say, I can handle a lot of life without alcohol. But when mm-hmm. it comes to the endless array of corporate demands, after 5 or 6 days, I crack and drink wine. Sometimes yeah. I feel like this pattern won't change until I can actually change my job. And I don't think that you shouldn't wait till your job changes to quit drinking.
No,
it is
no.
possible. People do stop drinking and it is way, way better in a super stressful job. And then you can make changes. So yeah. don't think I have to keep drinking because of this job, but you are not wrong that like that job might make you want to drink. And that
yeah. is
good information, you know?
Like I would say to her, like that if you quit drinking, things will get easier. You're like, yeah. The job is probably harder than she even realizes because of the drinking. But then also the fact that she's a consultant is interesting because it's like, how much of this is corporate, is strictly coming from corporate stress, and how much of it is like, does she have too many clients? Is she taking on too much? You know, I don't know, but these are questions. If she quits drinking and just don't change anything else for a while, just don't, and don't even, I see women be like, and I also gave up sugar and I also gave up caffeine. Oh my God, I'm just like, yeah. you're going to fail. Like, go get yeah. some sugar right now, you know, wait, and don't worry if you gain a little weight, your first, whatever, just stay sober. And, but then she might start to be able to say, oh, well, I actually do need to have 10% fewer clients. And can I afford to do that? And how can I make that happen? You know, and then you can make these small tactical changes. And I think often people are waiting for some huge mindset shift that'll make it easy. Like, now I'm empowered. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes it's like small tactical changes that you make. Like, she starts declining meetings that happen after 6, or something, you know,
like small shifts you can make based on your own personal life and talking to people. And I do want to talk about how that worked for you at Amazon, because I know it's a particularly bruising culture. So I work in Seattle. I worked in e-commerce for years. Mm-hmm. And every time, I mean, I've been here 23 years. Every time I change jobs, you interview at like 8 companies. So you know, there are the typical ones like Amazon, Microsoft, Expedia, Starbucks. Like you just interview at all of those. So
I've
Amazon 5 different times. Back
That's
in
right.
2000, in 2004, in 2008. Mm-hmm. Never took the job or never kept going in the interviews. I'm sure some was them, some was me. But a couple things that I thought was interesting. I mean, I have tons of friends who worked at Amazon, a lot of women. Some one or two stayed 10 years, most lasted 2. But, you know, I went through one interview loop and I knew someone who knew the team, right? So I had the inside scoop. And it went really, really well. And then this one guy came in and was just a complete and total dick to me. And you talk about this, the bar raiser. No, hurt, like no smile, no like positive response, just a blank slate. And then my friend called me and she was like, he loved you. And I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? He was a total and complete dick to me. And she's like, oh, we do that to see how you handle negative feedback. And I was like, I don't fucking want to work there.
Right. And they, and that is not a, that, like, that is not policy. Like,
oh, like, it's not?
No. I was a bar raiser. I mean, you know, the policy, and of course, in a company of, you know, 100,000 people or what, or a million people, like, policy doesn't mean that much. But like, no, you're supposed to, every client is like, every interview candidate is, first of all, they're probably a customer. Second of all, they have friends who also are in the workforce. And so you're always supposed to make sure they have a good
They're not experience. Supposed to be told a dick to you?
No, no. I'm not surprised it happened because there are people who interpret bar raiser that way. But like I was a bar raiser and the way that I got the best information out of people was to make them comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, including some candidates, like some guys who were just total jackasses. And the way I could keep them talking was just basically to be like, oh, tell me more about that, you know, and they would just tell me these terrible stories about themselves that just had me like horrified. But I'm not surprised that happened to you because I do think there is this culture where, I mean, there was a woman who worked for me, this younger woman who was amazing. Like she will be, we'll all be working for her someday. But at one point she said, well, you know, of course when I'm bar raising, I never smile. I just make sure I'm it's total poker face. And I was like, Sarah, it's okay to be nice to the candidates.
Yeah.
And she's very young and she looked at me and she was like, really? And I said, yeah, yeah. You know, how are you going to get a good performance out of someone if they're terrified? You can put an interview at Amazon is stressful enough.
Yeah.
You know, without being hostile. Yeah. And you could ask people tough questions. Like I used to love to ask people, we'd have these competencies and one of the things Amazon values is being able to be vocally self-critical. Partly because like they just like people who like to beat themselves up, but also because it's actually valuable to be like, oh, I can see where this went wrong, you know, rather than trying to hide mistakes, just to actually be like, oh yeah, here's where we fucked up and here's how we can fix it. And so if I were to ask people that in like a hostile way, they wouldn't be able to give me an answer. I had to, so I'd always be like, so here's why we care. And here's like a mistake I made just this month, for example. How about you? And then they could kind of be like, oh, yeah. Because, like, it wasn't like some mean lady trying to make them cry. But yeah, it is that I'm like, it's funny. I've been gone for 5 years and I'm still mad that that happened to you. And I'm like, I need to call. How do I fix this? Who do I talk to?
Well, I'm reading your book and I'm mad about, like, 18,000 things that happen to you. So,
oh yeah.
Get started. Let's have you read the one about, you know which one. I lost the page.
Is it professional help?
That one. And
yeah,
this was when you were just sort of getting
new-ish
started. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Yeah. I think this comes like probably 6 months into my career. Okay. This chapter is called Professional Help. By day, I learn Amazon, and at night, I seek out articles and listicles and TED Talks on femaling in the business world, just in case there are tips or hacks or something that could help me do it better. This is how I know I should lean forward in my chair far enough to show warmth, but not cleavage, but also sit with my shoulder blades against the chair back and my feet on the floor. That I should stand with my hands on my hips, but never cross my arms. Make eye contact for at least 2 seconds, but never more than 5. Look at a man's forehead and eyes, aka the business triangle, but never his nose or mouth, the social triangle. Listen with attentive interest, but without nodding or tilting my head. Speak naturally, but never end on an upswing. Speak assertively, but don't interrupt. When interrupted by a man, insist on finishing my thought, but charmingly, so he won't feel as though he did anything wrong. Don't volunteer to take meeting notes because it will seem secretarial, but do volunteer to take meeting notes because it's the only way to make sure my contributions will be captured. Do negotiate for more money, but don't let on that money motivates me. Be an advocate for women at work, plural, but not for myself as a woman at work, singular. Always take credit for my accomplishments, but also let my accomplishments speak for themselves. Raise my hand for new assignments to be helpful, not eager. Dress to embrace my femininity, but also to de-emphasize my boobs, shoulders, waist, hips, legs, lips, and hair. And smile, but not too much. Left, left. Yeah, like that. Now hold.
I mean, it's just like that Barbie speech. It's too hard. It's mm-hmm. too contradictory. It's too ridiculous that women have to twist themselves into a yeah. pretzel to yeah. not threaten men, not offend men, but not be called a bitch or ambitious or be seen as wishy-washy or too timid or whatever the fuck it is. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, there's all these rules and why, I mean, I don't think there are very few books for men on like how to stand, you know, here's how to sit correctly. When I hear about a vocal upswing or vocal fry, people get so mad about it. And I understand that there is something in the way it can make someone sound uncertain. But I also know that we all know by now that it's just a speech pattern. And I truly think if men were the ones who ended sentences on an upswing, nobody would care. We've decided it's wrong because it's the way women talk.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. I don't know about you, but I cannot believe how fast this year is flying by. We're all busy. But one of the most important things you can do to make sure you're on the right path is to carve out some time to celebrate your victories and to notice what you've wanted to change but haven't been able to yet. Whether you're navigating sobriety, setting boundaries, or striving to be the best version of yourself, therapy can be a game changer. Therapy is for anyone looking for growth and support. And if you're considering it, why not give BetterHelp a try? It's convenient, it's flexible, and it's entirely online. So take a moment for yourself and visit betterhelp.com/someday to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/someday.
Yeah.
You know, and we decided that, you know,
the model for a successful executive mm-hmm. has and continues to be men. So
right.
women are held up like, oh, if you want to be a VP or a GM or whatever, you have to act like this, when our entire lives we've been socialized to do something different.
Yeah. And yeah.
It's natural. I was at a company that was run by older British men, and I got promoted to this director level position because I did really good fucking work. I'm sure I was like better than all the men because they wouldn't have promoted me otherwise. Trust me.
Right.
They
didn't. Right.
The only reason I got promoted was a bunch of women who were at a higher level than me actually went to the SVP of marketing and was like, are you really going to lose her over this?
Right. Like, right.
You need to hire her, because he was like, no, she's too young. She's not right. Whatever. But I was told I talk too fast and I'm too excitable. And I was just dude, that's passion. I was director of product marketing for fucking entertainment imagery. We're talking Britney Spears and Lindsay Lohan and Angelina Jolie. I'm just like, I am the target market.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Like, I know what's needed here. Yeah. And it gets to the point where you just can't be natural. You know, I think about when Hillary Clinton was running for president, there were all these things like, well, she seems stiff. She doesn't seem authentic. You know, Bernie Sanders, he seems authentic. And I'm like, well, because he can be.
Yeah.
Like, he could show up in his fucking windbreaker and being like, bah, 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 bah. You know, like, I'd hear people criticize her speaking voice. And I was like, well, his is not exactly mellifluous either, but it's all right because he's a man. And meanwhile, if she'd shown up sounding and looking like that, she would have been like hanged. But if she shows up in her pantsuits and very polished, and she's fake. And I was just like, well, I don't know what the fuck she's supposed to do. There's nothing she could do.
But they talk about it at a bar after they've been like slighted for the 17th time. Like, we always talk about how men fail up, you know, they just do. They're like, oh, he sucks at this. He must have management potential. And I'm like, what the actual?
Right. Like, how if women, I've heard there's actual data on this somewhere, but women get promoted based on their accomplishments and men get promoted based on their potential.
Yeah.
Really, it should be somewhere in the middle for everyone. Right. Well, right.
Yeah. And it's just, it's infuriating. And we have a company in Seattle. I believe it's called Textio.
Yeah.
They're
amazing.
They do analysis of job specifications, job descriptions, and performance rating, you know, template to strip out not masculine language, but like, you know, there are all these terms that are basically describing a stereotypical man's attributes.
Right. And aggressive, relentless.
Yeah. And so therefore people are being hired by like, oh, do they seem aggressive and relentless and XYZ? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the data shows that women and people with some of the stereotypical building consensus, bringing everyone along, you know, champion people's strengths, whatever it is, actually have better revenue performance.
No, and it's funny, the woman who runs Textio actually worked at Amazon for just a couple of years, I think. She's a data scientist by trade, I think. And we actually ended up, I mean, I think every company, like the org I was in, started using their products, and we did run our job descriptions through their feeders to see, and we change things, you know, because we have things like, you know, aggressive and relentless and just words that it's not even just that only men are going to be drawn to them. I actually think a lot of men who are like maybe a little older and have families are kind of over that shit too.
Yeah.
You know, I remember reading internal job descriptions when I was looking for a new role at one point, and it was like, this is after I was sober, but it was like, you know, we have beer Tuesdays and football wars and we have Nerf wars. And I was like, you know, I am a 46-year-old mid-career woman. I don't give a talk about your Nerf war. I don't want anyone firing projectiles at me. Like, tell me what my opportunities are going to be and what are you going to pay me? And I thought, you know, it can't just be me and it can't just be women who, like, that is not the idea.
No, I mean, I can see, like, men, yeah, mid-career men who are like, dude, yeah. I don't know this. I think in the book you described, like, the brotastic. I liked other parts of your book. I like that you use the term brotastic. And any book that uses the term big swingy dick move, I'm pro. Oh, right. I'm always right. Like, oh, you're a big swingy dick, aren't you? Like,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
Because that would be rude. But, like, I'm like, yep.
Yep. And there are times like you want, like, you want like a divorce lawyer. That's probably who you want. You know, like there's times you want those people, but you don't necessarily want to hang out with them. We used to say I'd be in these meetings at Amazon with, you know, like 15 high ranking men and like two other women. And we'd be like, oh, here's the point in the meeting where they're all going to get their dicks out and put them on the table and have to measure them. You know, you could just see it coming. We'd know based on the document we'd written. We're like, here's where it's going to happen. And we kind of look at each other like, yep, here it goes. And a lot of these guys weren't even like that. I mean, these are pretty high ranking men. Like they were serious people for the most part. Like there's this misconception about places like Amazon and tech. The people who work at them are idiots.
No, I don't think that.
Not at all. You know, it's funny how often you'll see people be like, oh, those tech people, the executives don't do any work. And I'm like, at Amazon, at least, like, there were people who were probably worth $15 million who were still working 80 hours a week. Like, there's just something in their brains. It's like this nature, nurture. I don't know what it is, but they kill themselves. Oh, but they just would have to, they would just have to measure it against each other. Like, and I just thought it was just such a strange thing, you know, that they couldn't just not.
Well, what's interesting when we talk about you put your job descriptions through that filter is Amazon has these leadership principles. I know about them too, you know, from having interviewed friends there. But some of the leadership principles are gendered and fostered this culture. So you wrote about the Amazon leadership principle, have backbone, disagree and commit. Leaders are obliged to challenge decisions, it says respectfully, but whatever. Even when doing so is uncomfortable or exhausting, conviction, tenacious, do not compromise for the sense of social cohesion, you know, then commit wholly, healthy conflict, better ideas. But then you wrote practice, it tends to be used as a cover for loud, rude men who talk before they think and weaponized against anyone enculturated not to act like a loud, rude man, right? Isn't that just what we're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, you take this great principle. Like, it's true. Like, if you have a company where nobody will disagree, you're going to end up doing mediocre work, you know? So, like
yes, men or women.
Right. It can work beautifully, you know, and I was on teams where it worked really well. But I remember I worked overseas sometimes. And the first time I went to Japan, I was meeting with some leaders to say, like, you know, here's my goals. What do you think my goals should be? And they all were like, well, see what you can do to get them to just speak up more. Like they're just, we don't hear from them and we know they have good ideas and they just seem to go along to get along. And so I was like, yes, I'm going to do that. And I get there and I've been in Japan for like all of 3 or 4 days. And I'm like, this is crazy. This is Japan. This is a culture where for hundreds, if not thousands of years, people are milder mannered. There's not the same emphasis on arguing, even that your average American would have. And a lot of them were women and, you know, who cover their mouths and they laugh. And it was just like, they were asking me to get people to go against like their, not just their corporate culture, their entire way of life. Yeah. And I just thought this is ridiculous. And so I started focusing on like, well, what are some ways I could get them to speak up more? Because we did want to hear from them that they would be comfortable with. You know, I started trying to sort of nudge them forward. I found the ones who were a little more Western in attitude, who were more willing to speak up, and I would leverage them to be like a spokesperson for the group and things. But there was this expectation that we could just somehow, you know, be like, don't be Japanese anymore.
And I was like, and there's not the assumption that they can't bring out their best work unless they act like someone else.
Exactly. That they couldn't be, that unless you were acting like not just a Western worker, but a Seattle tech bro, that you're not going to be doing great work. And they were doing great work. And I also found, so after I got sober, I had always been told in my performance reviews that I was too nice, that I needed to argue more, I needed to disagree more. And I would always say, you know, but every time I have a disagreement, I do speak up. Like, I'm not sitting there dying to say something and not saying it. I'm pleasant about it. And I would feel like I was supposed to be arguing just to argue, which I just couldn't bring myself to do. But after I got sober, I did become a more direct person. I started to speak up more when I disagreed. I started to be a little blunter because I just felt more solid in myself. And like, people did not like that. And it wasn't like I turned into a dick. I was still me.
They said they wanted it, and then you did it. Right. They were like, actually, yeah, I'm going to criticize you for that too.
Yeah, like, where was that sweetheart before? And it was just funny because I think I changed maybe, 20%. I went from like a mildly reserved person, not very reserved, to like a mildly outspoken person. And yeah, I had people, like, one of my performance reviews said, she doesn't suffer fools gladly. And that was a criticism. And I was like, am I supposed to suffer fools gladly? Like,
how'd you know it was a criticism? Was it in the, like, areas for improvement? Because yeah. I think that would be a compliment.
Right, exactly. And I mean, we all know people who don't suffer fools gladly in a way that actually is mean and abusive. Yeah. Like, that, I'm pretty sure that was not me because it's not my temperament. But yeah, it was an area for development to basically be more patient with dummies. And at that point, I was just like, you know what? I already knew I was kind of on my way out. I was sort of like, I need to blow this pop stand. And I was like, I am not going to like try to change my personality again. And I had friends, women friends who were, you know, more male in their communication style, like very blunt, the kind of blunt I could never be, who were called like abrasive and, the words like that men just don't get called. So it was absolutely a double-edged sword. And here's the danger with a place like Amazon is most of the men I worked with, I think they think they are egalitarian. I did not work with many men who would be like, yeah, I don't think women are really suited for these jobs.
Yes.
I think most of the men I work with are probably like, well, yeah, women can do this too, but it's a meritocracy. And they think meritocracy is a neutral thing. You know what I mean? Like, they don't understand that if someone built that system and decided what counts and what should be measured. So if you say everyone should argue productively, they're just like, well, we should all do it. And there's not this understanding that it doesn't work out well for women to do that. So when women don't do it, they're like, well, they're not a culture fit. And when women do it, they're like, ooh, they're abrasive.
Oh my God. There was this section of your book where you talk about the gender split and how it works when it goes up. And then this conversation you had with all these men. And
yes.
I read it out loud to my husband. And was like, fuck. And it took him a couple rounds to figure out exactly what I was pissed about. Like,
well, this.
And it reminded me of my husband's awesome, yada, yada, all the things. But like, I was like, you are not getting why I'm pissed about this. So in the book, you talk about entry level gender split is roughly equal. Manager level. Women have shrunk to a third. At your level, they were a quarter. And higher up, it was even lower.
It's like 20% and it just goes, I think at the time on the S team, which is the name for the people who reported directly to Jeff Bezos, I think there was one woman out of like 18 people at the time. Yeah. So it's like a reverse funnel. You know, we just disappear and we use this data as the teaching exercise and the men were just, I used to have a bet with a female friend on the team about how long it would take someone to say, well, we need to be teaching, preschool girls how to code.
Oh my God. And it took like 2 seconds, right?
We stopped betting eventually because it was like, what's the point? We both know they're just going to say it right away. Men love to say this because it's like, first of all, no one's going to say no. Like, no, let's not do that. But it also kicks the can down the road, like 20 years. So like someday these three-year-olds can maybe get tech jobs. They never want to talk about how to deal with the women who are there today. It's always about these cute toddlers who are going to learn to program computers.
And which what also you said, like, yeah, but at entry level, it's a 50-50 split.
Right.
So it's not that we aren't getting enough women in the door.
Right. They're leaving. They're leaving.
And you said, like, you wrote, the questions you asked were, are we leaving or just getting passed over for promotions into management? When we leave, are we going to other companies or dropping out of the workforce entirely? What's the offer rate for external female versus male candidates? Like, those were the questions. And when you asked the men, yeah, they didn't come up with any of those.
No, I mean, I was, you know, Amazon's so data driven. I was like, give me more data. You know, I wanted to know all this stuff. And the men just, the other thing they say a lot is like, well, women just have different priorities. This is a way of saying we don't have accessible childcare in this country.
Yeah.
And men don't do their share of the parenting. So, you know, most of the women that I worked with who were in leadership, like a lot of them just didn't have kids like me, you know, that certainly simplifies things. But they didn't say like, well, we need to have accessible daycare, maybe on-site daycare at Amazon. It was just like different priorities. And then they would fall back on, oh, my favorite, women are too smart to want these jobs.
Yes.
These jobs are so hard.
In the thing, I wrote ha 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 in my you know,
exactly,
because it was like, my point is not everyone wants these executive level jobs like we do. Honestly, it's a sign of superior intelligence that women decide to do something else with their lives. Ha 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 ha.
Ha ha
like,
ha.
Fuck yourself.
It's
right?
The most nauseating thing. Like, these men will kill each other to get these jobs. And it was like, you'd have guys who'd be like, well, I'm VP of whatever team and my wife is CEO of our house, you know? And it's like, these guys' wives, like, they had like Harvard law degrees. Like, these were women who had been like serious achievers until they had a child. And then they'd always be like, we just decided it made more sense for her to be the one to stay home. And it's like, but why? I mean, I can see if you're breastfeeding or something, but it's like beyond the first few years, does it automatically make sense for the woman to be the one at home?
Interesting to me is that when Mike and I had kids, I was making 2 to 3 times what he made. He was a 6th grade teacher at a private school.
Oh, and wow. Yeah. Yeah.
We did have that discussion because for a couple of years, we would probably be paying not as much, but close to as much in daycare, because it's crazy in Seattle, as his salary. But the question was, would he be happy? It wasn't those couple of years. It would affect his ability to get additional job. It would
his whole career. Yeah.
What he wanted. And we were like, no, we're going to pay for daycare. Because But like, of course, that is a financial choice we were lucky enough to be able to make.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, if you can't afford daycare, that's a totally different story. But the Amazon shit is like, you are saying in the book, like, there's no information on whether people were parents or not. Like, you're assuming.
Right.
And then the other thing you wrote, which cracked me up, was it's like, the guy's like, Amazon doesn't support work-life balance for anyone. It just affects women differently because we're moms. So,
right. And I wasn't a mom. I mean,
oh my God. But the question was like, what can we do to support healthier work-life balance for everyone? Oh my God. That reminded me of like All Lives Matter movement, right?
It was
like
very all lives matter.
You are not like, there are 20, we go from 50% to 20%. But like All Lives Matter, what about healthier work-life balance for everyone? And I'm like, that's not the issue.
Right. And it was also what we would call at Amazon boiling the ocean. You know, when like the question we posed to them was like, what specific like levers would you pull if you wanted to start solving this? You know, what are some very tactical things? Like, would we have on-site daycare? And they were like, well, but we would need better work-life balance. It's like when people talk about gun control and they're like, we just need to become a less violent society. And I'm like, well, good luck with that. How about if we pass one law that, like, you know, does away with X, Y, or Z? People, you know, people don't want to solve a problem when they go straight to, like, we need to erase hatred from society, you know, yeah, instead of, like, let's illegalize, you know, automatic weapons or something. And so they didn't want to talk about, like, a thing we could actually do. It had to be about how do we solve this for everyone. And it was very much, I remember there was a point where diversity became a real sort of broad topic at Amazon for a while. You know, not just women, but people of color. I mean, there's a lot of people from India who work at Amazon and a lot of people from Asia, but not a lot of Black people, not a lot of Latinx people. And so within like 2 days, the phrase thought diversity had been introduced. And I was like, what does this mean, thought diversity? And because I'd never heard it before. And I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. And all the men, just all the white men just picked it up. They were like, hey, as long as there's thought diversity, we're good. So I was like, so you could be from Stanford or MIT. Either one is fine as long as there's thought diversity. And it was just a way, and they all just glommed onto it. It's like, well, we don't need to worry about whether we have people who've lived as women or Black people or whatever, as long as we have thought diversity, not realizing like thought diversity comes largely from living different lives.
Experiences. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's, and also that women make the majority. I mean, Amazon's not just a retail company anymore, but women make the majority of household purchase decisions. Yes. And like, it was a little weird that we didn't have more women running the website, you know, as customer advocates. So yeah, there was a lot of just men wanting to kind of feel good about themselves. And I think that men don't have the ability to depersonalize. And I saw this as some of the reaction to Barbie, you know, like, wow, there wasn't a man I could feel good about in the movie. And it's like, well, so like, just because some man does something bad, it doesn't mean that you're bad. You know, it's kind of like with Me Too, the not all men acknowledgement. Men did not want to step back and think, oh, I could be part of the system that is excluding a lot of valuable contributions. So they would just sort of close their eyes and say, well, let's just teach the toddlers.
When you're in this environment where you feel like you can't keep up, your strengths aren't valued, you are second guessing and overthinking how to sit, how to act, how to hold your hands, how to modulate your voice.
Yeah.
That we are, you know, the easy button is to drink, right? That's the socially acceptable way to numb yourself out. Mm-hmm. And in this book, you know, you talk about it a lot, but in subtle ways that I completely and totally related to, where you're waking up at 6:30 in the morning, waking up afraid because it's a Tuesday and you're making a smoothie to cancel out the bottle of wine from the night before. And then later, a couple chapters later, you said, my wine consumption is ticked up to X glasses of wine a night, parens. From this point forward, please add 2 to however many glasses of wine I tell you I'm drinking. I was yep, I feel that, you know?
Just like doctors apparently assume, they're taught to assume people are lying by like 1 or 2 or something.
Oh my God. For me, I'd be like, please add 5 bottles to however many glasses of wine
put that in my chart, you know? Yeah. And I am, because it was very subtle like that. And also I was starting to make like a lot of money, and like wine is it's a rich person habit, you know, it doesn't have to be, but like, if you want to spend a lot of money on wine, you know, it's a passion. There's education you could do, like all the stuff. And
just by the way, all fucking marketing, you know, right? Let's
It's all marketing.
Genius marketing ploy.
Yeah, yeah. So like, I was in like wine clubs, and you know, I could just throw away lots of money on wine, and I really liked it. You know, I think wine is really interesting, but it's not that interesting, you know. There was a VP at Amazon who always had like really amazing scotches, like expensive scotches in her office. And it wasn't like she was sitting in there in the middle of the day, like swigging it, but you would go places and like bottles of liquor were just on people's desks. Like in the design studio in my last role there, there was just a bottle of tequila, like on one of the tables. And I don't even remember ever seeing anyone open it, but it was just there all the time. And I remember thinking, this isn't normal. Like, this is not normal for an office to just have like liquor sitting around. Like we wouldn't have piles of cocaine sitting around.
It actually is in a bunch of workplaces.
It's true.
Like for employee morale, you know, companies have like a beer cart that goes around at 4 o'clock on a
Friday. Yeah.
Hi there. If you're listening to this episode and have been trying to take a break from drinking, but keep starting and stopping and starting again, I want to invite you to take a look at my on-demand coaching course, the Sobriety Starter Kit. The Sobriety Starter Kit is an online self-study sober coaching course that will help you quit drinking and build a life you love without alcohol, without white-knuckling it, or hating the process. The course includes the exact step-by-step coaching framework I work through with my private coaching clients, but at a much more affordable price than one-on-one coaching. And the Sobriety Starter Kit is ready, waiting, and available to support you anytime you need it. And when it fits into your schedule, you don't need to work your life around group meetings or classes at a specific day or time. This course is not a 30-day challenge or a one day at a time approach. Instead, it's a step-by-step formula for changing your relationship with alcohol. The course will help you turn the decision to stop drinking from your worst case scenario to the best decision of your life. You will sleep better and have more energy. You'll look better and feel better. You'll have more patience and less anxiety. And with my approach, you won't feel deprived or isolated in the process. So if you're interested in learning more about all the details, please go to www.sobrietystarterkit.com. You can start at any time, and I would love to see you in the course.
Yeah, yeah, or like the taps of the kitchen, the craft beer taps, and it's just, I don't know, I think it's strange. Like, there's nothing wrong with like, yeah, an employee happy hour now and then. You know, it's not like that's just inherently evil. But I think the worst like employee, you know, team bonding event I ever went on was it was a wine tasting afternoon. And in their defense, like I had joined the team after this was already planned, but we went to Woodinville.
Sober?
I was sober. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I'd been sober for years at that point, but we went to Woodinville and went to three different wineries and I actually wasn't the only person on the team who didn't drink either. Like my boss didn't drink. And so the two of us were kind of just standing around while people tasted wine for like 4 hours. And I was so bored. And so I always say to people now, like, just think about things like that. Like the best team building event. First of all, I could do without team building events completely.
Oh my God.
The best one I ever went on was actually, first of all, it was during the day. So you're not having to take extra time. We took a glass blowing workshop.
I've done that as a team building.
That was fun. Let me tell you, they don't let you drink there. For good reason. There's no drinking. You're too like, whoa, I'm blowing glass to be like worried about anything else. And I was like, oh, I actually am doing something new. So I was like, do something with your teams or just keep in mind that like drinking is not an activity. Like that is not a full social activity.
Well, and I think it is again shifting, right? With the whole sober curious movement I got interviewed for an HR company magazine about like how to make holiday parties for companies more inclusive of people who don't drink. So at least on the agenda now, whereas it used to be, I mean, not for everyone, but it used to be like a get super shit-faced and do inappropriate stuff, which
It's definitely changed. And like, even in my last org at Amazon, like I think Anjali came out after I'd been there like 6 months. It basically got to the point that like this entire org of like 800 people kind of knew there was a sober, you know, yeah. Like I'd have total strangers be like, hi, I read your article. So the SVP of this org, who is an absolute doll, we would have these, it was for Amazon Go. We were launching this huge thing. So we'd have these celebrations sometimes for big milestones. And I noticed they just quietly had like there'd be champagne on one side of the room. On the other side of the room, there'd be sparkling wine. Like, whereas before it would have been maybe some cans of Coke. It was equal, you know, and I'm not someone who cares about like fake sparkling wine. Like I was happy with a Diet Coke, but I was like, that is a really nice thing to do. And they didn't make a big thing out of it. They just had, they were like, here's the champagne. Here's the non-alcoholic stuff. And I started to notice that, you know, especially in a tech company, there were a lot of people who didn't drink. There were a lot of people who'd grown up like Muslim or Hindu who
yeah.
had never had a drink in their lives. And then some who had started it when they came here. But I was like, right, there's people who, and a lot of people from Utah who'd grown up Mormon who just didn't drink. I was like, there's just people who just don't drink. And I never bothered to find out these people existed.
Yeah.
Yeah. As a drinker. So I suddenly had all these new friends who were like, you know, all from like, Bangalore or something, you know, and I was getting to know them because like, I was like, oh, I can talk to you. You're not shit faced. Mm-hmm. And it was great.
Yeah. Well, at one point you talk about when you were stopping drinking. And I mm-hmm. think that most people can relate to this. Because I've seen it in myself and my clients, like the back and forth rationalization and contradiction. Mm-hmm. So you start in Honor Berries saying mm-hmm. about drinking all the time, what bottle I should open, what tricks I can employ to stop myself from drinking, how I can stop myself from drinking the whole thing. And then you in the same paragraph, but I'm desperate to stop thinking about drinking. So I'll just stop the rumination and just be a carefree, thoughtless drinker. Like my clients have told me, I'm tired of thinking about drinking. Maybe that's the problem. So mm-hmm. I'll just go back to drinking and not try to stop. And that's going to be the solution, right? That's the
clue. Yeah. Yeah, I totally fell for that. And there's this idea that I think it's true in a lot of ways that women can overthink sometimes. So I was like, I'm overthinking. And it's like, yeah, I was overthinking in the wrong direction. You know, what I had to do, the way to stop overdrinking was just to take alcohol out of my life. And I think it was like that paradox of choice. You know, when you have too many options and you just can't, like streaming TV sometimes, like I end up watching nothing because I can't decide between seven things. It was kind of like that. And the way I found out about Belle Robertson is I Googled the phrase tired of thinking about drinking. And that was the name of her website. I mean, that's how I found it. And I was desperate not to worry about it anymore. And I think something in me was just like, I'm not going to let you stop worrying about this because it's going to kill you at some point. You know, my body was like, no, the brain is going to keep remembering that this is a problem. And when I finally stopped trying to moderate, which is like the worst, you know, just taking it off the table was like the biggest freedom. It was kind of like if I, you know, had negative gastrointestinal effects from a certain kind of food, but I liked it so much that I kept having little bits of it and I kept getting sick. Like if I were suddenly like, you know what, I'm just allergic to this. I can't have it. My life would get much simpler. And that's how it was with alcohol.
So people are going to want to know how mm-hmm. did you do it, right? You've got just this woman who wrote me. You have this intense pressure, job, nothing is ever enough, tons of stress. Mm-hmm. And by the way, your love to drink slash have become depending on whether it's habitually or it's your way to relax or whatever. So how did you stop?
I had been tiptoeing up to the idea that I needed to stop. I knew about Belle's 100-day challenge. I had emailed her and said, I said, I might be ready at some point soon. And she just emailed back and said, we'll be here when you are, you know. And I woke up one morning with a hangover. My husband was out of town for a week. And I was just like, that's it. you know, it wasn't even the worst hangover than usual. I just thought, I'm going to do this now while I'm alone so I can just go into the cave. And I somehow, I mean, the first
few nights. Were you working that week? I mean, maybe not that week.
Yeah. I was working. It was the week, and that was the weekend that I was working that week. Mm-hmm. And I got through the first, it was horrible. I mean, I was terrified. I went to lunch with my best friend that day. I didn't say a thing to her about it. I just didn't tell anyone. And, you know, I somehow got through the first two nights. And I did take a sleeping pill the first night. I was terrified of not being able to sleep. And I was like, well,
because you're like, I can't function.
Right. I was like, I have to sleep. And I was like, and you're not addicted to pills, so that's fine. Like, you don't have to make this like train spotting, like detoxing in a jail cell or something. And once I'd gotten through two nights, let's see, I mean, I remember at work that day, that first Monday, just being terrified because I would just think, oh my God, I can't drink tonight. I can't drink tonight. And I think I arranged that week to be out of my house a lot. Like I went to a couple, it's handy sometimes not having children. And, our dog was boarded that week, I think. And I would go to a 5 p.m. movie, you know, just whatever was playing that looked like tolerable because I was just there and I could, or I would go out to a bookstore. I'd go to yoga. Like I had to get myself past like 8 p.m. And somehow if I could do that, I was like, okay, I'm going to make it to the next morning. And then every morning I would feel like the biggest success in the world because I got through another day without drinking.
So and you like you were like a daily bottle of wine girl for a while.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, daily bottle of wine or a little more.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've done that for sure on a Tuesday.
Yeah. And I didn't like throw out anything. I didn't even want to touch the wine in the fridge. I just didn't even touch it. And like by the end of the week, I was already feeling like to have like, I think it was like 7 days of not drinking under my belt was huge because I literally did not think I could do it. So I was just high on that.
Yeah.
I wasn't like disappointing myself anymore. And here's the other thing, and this ties into like the work thing is I was able to be a success every day if I just didn't drink. And Amazon is a place where they really don't want you to ever feel like a success because like it kind of runs on fear. You know, your fear that I'm not enough, so I'm going to work harder. Plus, let's face it, even in an affirming workplace, you know, you're not going to feel like you did something great every day. Like a lot of days are just like, yep, I went to my meetings. I didn't break anything. You're not going to feel like a superhero ordinarily, but I felt like a rock star. Every day because I just didn't drink. And so I got really hooked on that feeling. I had to lower the bar for myself, really, to just be like, this is success for you. And that went a long, long way. I also realized I had to be nice to myself, which I had not done in many, many years. I mean, Amazon, again, discourages people from being nice to themselves, but I had already started that. Like, you know, they knew they picked me for a reason. And so I started just like buying myself little treats or magazine or, you know, just dumb little things, getting a manicure. And I was like, oh, I like this. I like being nice to myself. So it became this virtuous cycle. And that's basically how I did it. I remember the first time I had to go to a work happy hour, sober, I was working in Amazon publishing and we had like 70 mystery authors or 50 mystery authors or something in town. And publishing is very boozy. Writers are very boozy. And we had this big happy hour at the Westin. And I was just terrified that people would notice I wasn't drinking, that I'd have to talk to people. But I was like, I had to go. And so I basically was like, okay, you're going to stay an hour and you're going to work the room. You're going to make a goal to talk to, I think I said like 20 people or something. And I realized a couple things right away. One was that nobody cared or noticed if I was drinking. I went and got like club soda and this is before the mocktail era, you know. And also
I know we're like old school, man. We're like OG.
Yeah.
No good. There was like fucking O'Doul's and cranberry and soda or ginger.
I mean, people do not have any idea how bad it was, you know. And I actually, from the beginning, would have soda with bitters. Mm-hmm. You know, bitters are pure alcohol, but it's like a couple drops. So I never felt like that was risky for me. So that gave me one option. But it was so bad out there. Like, it's a golden age now. I was offered a smoothie once. It's like, to go with like fish.
Better than like tap water.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing was so sad.
Oh my God. I was driving with Lila today. You're like, it was so bad. It was off. I was driving with Lila today and she was like, so you didn't have texting when you were little. Like, you didn't have, I was like, dude, we wrote fucking letters. And she's like, I don't understand. And I was like, we wrote notes at class and we wrote letters. Yeah. And we talked in person and like
sat. Our phones had dials. You had to dial like 7 numbers. It was just, so, like, they were just busy signals.
Anyone getting sober now, it's like you have a cell phone and can text.
Yeah.
And I had like stamps.
Right. Exactly. I mean, it's crazy. But it was so empowering to go to this thing and just be like, oh, I'm working the room. Because the other thing is, it's not like I was just some like drunk at company events before, but I would inevitably, you have a couple drinks and you end up just talking to your one little group or to someone for, and this way I was like, okay, well, I need to gracefully move on from this person to get to this other person. And so I started thinking, so I was actually better at my job. And it also proved to me that like I could do this. Like I could walk up and introduce myself to people. And I don't have social anxiety anymore. I mean, I have little bits, of course, but
despite being an introvert, you talk about that.
Right. I'm an introvert, but I could talk to pretty much anyone at this point. I mean, I could walk into a room and I might not be like delighted, but I'll just walk up to someone and say hi, you know, and it's, and I hear people say sometimes like, once I deal with my social anxiety, I want to quit drinking. And the thing I want to say to them is like, you might need to do it the other way around because you're never going to deal with your social anxiety until you quit drinking.
I feel
and
like
you have to just pull the band-aid off.
For everyone, and I know people don't want to hear this, but like people will say to me like, my marriage sucks. Mm. Once something happens in my marriage, whatever, my husband's nicer, I leave him or I don't or something, marriage therapy somehow works, then I'll stop drinking. And I'm just, it's like with the stressful job or the difficult relationship with the kid or social, like you have to remove the drinking first.
Right.
A lot of life gets better. Like my marriage
got
better. My perception of marriage got way better. But if not, even if it doesn't, you can see it clearly and you're capable
of
changes and you're proud of yourself and you deserve more.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You, if you take the thing out that's clouding your thinking, dragging your body down. I mean, it was tiring me out in ways I didn't even realize, you know, like, so my life got better in these ways that I didn't even think it needed to get better. And also, I mean, you can, if you do all that and it turns out like nothing gets better, you can always bring the drinking back.
The wine is going to be there. Like,
yeah, no one's going to stop. No one's going to stop you. I mean, but I do think most people who get it out of their lives, at minimum, even if they weren't really problem, I know people who just stopped because like they were training for a marathon or something, you know, and although I trained for marathons drinking.
Dude, and then I did like, everything. Oh. I was hungover, like literally triathlons, job interview. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. All the morning plane flights, like you name it. I was hungover. Yeah.
But like, I know people who just quit for some reason like that. And they're just like, oh, you know what? I feel better now. I don't want it. You know, so you don't have to be like even what they would call a gray area drinker. You could just be someone who's like, oh yeah, no, I wasn't that much of a drinker. Now I don't want to be a drinker at all. Like there's no downside to getting alcohol out of your life. It just means it's going to be uncomfortable for a while. Yeah. Guess what? So is life. You know, like if you want to do anything hard, you're going to have to, things are going to suck sometimes.
But
it's
and then
really when unfortunate.
I'm like, oh my God, I can do anything if I stop.
Well, I still think that sometimes I'm still like, if you stop drinking, you can do this, whatever this other thing is that you think you can't do, because it really is. It's been 10 years for me now, so I can get kind of far away from what that was like, you know. But I'm on this this Facebook group. It's like a Peloton sobriety group. Mm-hmm. And it is the most like affirming place. And there's all these people on it who are on like day 6 or day 13. And just hearing them. And what I love about this group is that it's not about like, I'm doing this so I can lose weight or something. Like, it's actually a real sobriety group. Mm-hmm. It's not like, I'm going to lose 13 pounds and so I cut beer, you know. It's been so good for me to just read these people and being like, I have to go to my first family barbecue sober, or like, my brother keeps teasing me. What do I do? And I'm just like, oh yeah, all this new stuff. It's yeah. so hard,
you know, navigating life all yeah. in a new way.
Yeah. Yeah. But then they come back and they're like, I did it. I went to the barbecue and like, yeah, parts of it were terrible, but it was actually okay. And I let myself leave early. And you're like, and now you've got that under your belt. It's like building muscle, new muscles.
Yeah.
You know, you have to lift heavy weights to build new muscles. Yeah. And then they've got to repair themselves. It's no different.
So tell me about your hopes for this book. Like, I want to know,
yeah.
obviously, like, low back, right? Like, is there any?
Yeah. There has so far not been any blowback. I was, I remember being like, is Amazon going to be mad at me? So, you know, but I wrote this book. Like, it's a pure memoir. You know, it's not a reported book. So. Yeah. When I needed to go look up a fact or something, you know, I always did it from public sources. A lot of times I would just go to Amazon's own press releases to be like, oh, did we have a kitchen store in 2007? Yeah. I don't remember, you know. And so I knew in my own conscience that I was writing my experience, my story, my truth, you know. And I also, the process of writing it was hard because so it took me 4 years to write. And the first year, at least, I felt like I was writing a failure story mm-hmm. and a trauma memoir. And so I always felt bad sitting down to write. And I was just like, oh, let's write about how I failed some more. And I realized that it was the voice of Amazon in my head
right.
That was coming at me about this book. And all I could think was like, well, what are people going to say from Amazon? Going to say they're going to trash me. They're going to whatever. And it was only in continuing to work on it and then with a really great writing group that I started to be like, this is actually kind of a hero's journey, like, and a coming of age story that I yeah. go through this thing and then I get myself out. And that really changed things for me. And I also gave myself permission to not try to like paint Amazon as all one way. Like, there were so many people when they found out I was writing this book who were like, I hope you blow the lid off that place and they end up in congressional hearings. And I was like, this is not that kind of book. Like, this book is not going to, there's no congressional hearings. It's not a policy book. I don't, as a citizen, I have opinions about that stuff. As a writer, I do not care. No. I want to write about a lunch I had with someone. And I basically at a point now where I'm like, I don't really care. What, like, if I wrote this book well, it could make people a little bit mad at me from many sides of the spectrum. You know, there will be people who are like, well, she's just whining. And there will be others who are like, oh, how could that Nazi ever work at Amazon in the first place? I mean, I've had people call me like a good German for working at Amazon. You know, like, they're
interesting. I am very curious for all the blowback you got for Anjali. Mm-hmm. Whether you get more or less for this book from men.
Yeah. You know? It's going to be interesting. So I normally don't look at Goodreads because writers should not, but my publisher has
that.
It's so toxic. It's so toxic for writers, but my publisher has a link to it on the book's page. And I saw that the star average was kind of high and I was like, huh, I'm going to go take a look. And like the first, and people have been very kind there. And the first couple of reviews were from men who love the book. And I had just sort of assumed that men would come after me for this book. And I'm sure some of them will. Like, I'm sure some tech bros will be like, well, she just couldn't hack it or whatever. But it was really interesting to see these guys just be like, oh, it was really, Amazon was interesting. And just to see how she reacted. And wow, there was some gender stuff I hadn't thought about. And And it was really validating. And then I've had, you know, some male friends who've read the book, who've loved it. I am sure there will be blowback. But so my friend Melissa Phoebos, she said something on Twitter not long ago, which is that if you are writing toward like a bad faith reader, you will write badly. So like, in other words, there are people who are just going to hate this book no matter what. Like, yeah, they hate it now when it's not even out. And some of them are people on the right and some of them are people on the left. Yeah. And, you know, and they're just going to hate it. And if I were to write defensively to try to make those people like me, it would be a bad book. It would be a watered down book. So mm-hmm. I just wrote it for like the other 80%. Yeah. And yeah, if people get mad, they get mad. I kind of feel like, I don't think there'll be any real reaction from Amazon. I sort of feel like they'll, you know, like it's on the site.
It's not, they're not going to send out like a link to your LinkedIn article, like that guy, Nick.
Right. I mean, I did wonder, I was like, after that Jodi Kantor story came out, there was some young guy who had the famous quote about like, I saw so many people crying at their desks. Amazon actually like trashed him publicly. They actually like revealed quotes from his performance reviews. I mean, it was ugly. And I was just like, this is bad. And I remember thinking, well, I guess they could like find like negative quotes from my performance reviews and bring those out. But then I was like, you know, do I care?
No. But also, like, that's crazy.
Yeah, I was like, I don't have any skeletons in the closet, and I think they will ignore it. I mean, I know there's lots of people inside the company who are very curious about it. Some of them have read it. I'm sure that the publisher will, you know, in advance, give a courtesy copy to the company or something. But yeah, it'll be interesting, like, in Seattle, where, like, everybody has such strong opinions about Amazon. And a lot of people work there, you know, or have worked there.
So many.
I am.
Well, Keith. Yeah. Okay, we have to have dinner again, and I want to hear out all the good stuff and the drama, because you know that's fun too.
Yeah, I would love it if people at Amazon actually read it and took it to heart. I mean, it would be amazing if like Andy Jassy read it and thought, huh, could we do some things better? But
thank you so much for coming on. I told you I read it and underlined like 50 pages. So I've got a million underlines we could not talk about, but that's okay.
That is okay. Thank you so much. People
underline their own stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. Get a page to come with a pen.
Yeah. You got to do a book club or something.
Yeah, I should. That would be really fun. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hello Someday podcast. If you're interested in learning more about me, the work I do, and access free resources and guides to help you build a life you love without alcohol, please visit HelloSomedayCoaching.com. And I would be so grateful if you would take a few minutes to rate and review this podcast, so that more women can find it and join the conversation about drinking less and living more.
Addiction impacts all of us. Addiction's consequences run through all of us. From ourselves to our loved ones and through our communities, addiction creates so much loss and grief. My name is Dwayne Osterlin, and I'm the host of the Addicted Mind podcast, a show featuring personal stories, expert guests, and vital information about addiction and addiction recovery. We'll talk with leading treatment providers to discuss the latest research and treatment options for this devastating disease and advocate for mental health awareness. We discuss topics like the importance of creating a community of support to helping loved ones, to some of the latest research on psychedelic medicines. The Addicted Mind podcast has been about creating hope, listening to stories of many amazing people that have overcome addiction and are thriving. If you or a loved one is struggling with addiction, subscribe to the Addicted Mind podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or check out theaddictedmind.com. New episodes every Monday. See you there.